On this day, 100 years ago, Tennessee became the final state needed to ratify the 19th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, making women's right to vote the law of the land. One historian in the Chattanooga area who knows that story well is Linda Moss Mines.
Linda, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
We are talking history, and we are talking the history of Tennessee and the 19th Amendment. Tell us about this centennial.
Oh my goodness, it's such an exciting time because, and I think especially for people who are younger than me, or even for me, since I'm not old enough to remember it, that we often take for granted the rights and privileges that we have as citizens of the country today, and we don't realize that in 1776, when the Declaration of Independence was written, in 1789, when the Constitution was written, there was no consideration for women in any role of citizenship, with voting being our primary responsibility. If you fast forward from 1776 to 1848, you have the first meeting of women, along with some men of future ideology, meeting at Seneca Falls to talk about a suffrage movement for women. And out of that came a lot of conversation and a lot of efforts, but no change to the U.S. Constitution to allow that. I find it interesting that from then, 1848, it is another 72 years exactly. And in 1920, we're going to see the face of citizenship in this country change. 1919, the U.S. Congress introduced into both houses and actually brought them to the floor, voted positively, and brought them out a change to the U.S. Constitution that would become the 19th Amendment. Very short and sweet statement that said that the right to vote would no longer be impaired by gender. President Wilson signs it, and the ratification process requires that it go to the states and that three-fourths of the states have to ratify that amendment. We had 48 states at the time, so 36 had to vote positively. And it wasn't certain that that would happen because for 26 years prior to 1919, a version of the 19th Amendment had been introduced to the U.S. Congress every year, and it had never even made it out of the two bodies. Now it's headed to the states, but that's even more uncertain because there were so many geographical ideological differences in how they viewed the right of women to vote.
A different ideological map than the ones that we can draw today.
Oh, certainly. Very much different ideologically. And, you know, you look back, and I've spent a lot of time over the last year reading the speeches of those who were in favor of the suffrage movement, speeches of those who were adamantly opposed to it. And it centers around social, political ideology, issues of faith, I mean, economics. It's a really interesting discussion when you look at it. But what we, of course, know now, and we will be celebrating, is Tennessee's vote. And it was the most historic of all of the state votes because as that amendment came out of Congress in 1919, almost immediately seven states ratified it. Michigan, New Jersey, a number of states in the Northeast, and then in spurts, additional states would ratify it. But when it came down to the summer of 1920, there were seven states left that had not voted on it. A number of states had voted no. There was pretty strong evidence of those seven states that only two were really in play, and that was Delaware and Tennessee. And Delaware had come out, the governor of Delaware had come out in favor of it, but he lost control of his own political party. They split on him. And all of a sudden, the entire eyes of the nation are focused on Nashville, Tennessee, quite frankly, as they often should be, but nonetheless, they're focused on Nashville, and no one knew what was going to happen. I mean, it was a hot, humid summer. You know, the Yellow Rose suffragettes are there campaigning. The Red Rose anti-suffragettes are there campaigning. And what people sometimes forget is that in every legislature across the nation that's going to be voting on this, it's 100% male. So those who are campaigning in either way have to be quite persuasive and eloquent in their arguments. And it was uncertain. The members of the House of Representatives, the Senate in Tennessee passed it very, very quickly. The House of Representatives was much more divided. You know, you could sometimes gauge because the men would wear either a red rose or a yellow rose in the lapel, but at times they didn't wear either. because they were uncertain. And that was a good way of knowing they were uncertain. There are wonderful stories of suffrage workers on either side chasing members of the House of Representatives through the halls of the Capitol. The Capitol was open to the public back then. And one of my favorite stories of all times involves a member of the House who just was not committing himself either way, and a suffrage worker had him cornered talking to him and actually took a hold of his tie to try and keep him focused on her argument. And he reached in his pocket, took out his pocket knife, cut his tie off, and fled into the men's room. Can't you just see that image? Unfortunately, when he came out of the men's room, she was standing in the doorway waiting for him. So she followed him until she could not enter the chamber floors. But I mean, that's how much passion there was in this. And of course, on August the 18th, 100 years to the day, the House of Representatives, in a vote that came down to the final vote, decided to ratify the 19th Amendment. And the minute that it came out of the chambers, the word spread that the House had ratified that amendment, joining with the Senate. Governor Roberts, who was from Overton County, Tennessee, Livingston, agreed to sign it. Of course, nationwide, there was pandemonium. People were either celebrating in every way with ticker tape parades and everything, or they were taking to their fainting couches. The end of society as they knew it was over. I mean, it's so hard to downplay how emotional it was for folks. Harry T. Byrne, who cast that vote from McMinn County, Athens, Tennessee, youngest member of the House of Representatives, and I think probably everyone who's listening has probably heard the story that his mother telegrammed him and quite succinctly said, "Please help Mrs. Catt put the rat in ratification." He votes positively, and those who were opposed to the vote turned on him, and he fled the chambers. And the story is, and the Capitol historian has told me this, that he went all the way to the top of the building, out a window, and sat on the roof for several hours waiting for things to calm down so that he could come back in. They didn't know where he had gone. And I guess they didn't think to look out the window and see him sitting on the roof. Interestingly, you know, you do that at age 27 and you become a national figure, and probably he never anticipated that as the youngest member of the House. You go to the House as a newly elected representative, a young member, and, you know, the first time or two, you're sort of quiet, you do your work. He's nationally prominent that very first time, and it pushes Tennessee into being the perfect 36, which I love. I love to know that Tennessee, which I think has always had an interesting dichotomy of being a southern state and conservative in some areas, but also progressive in other areas. And I love that it puts us right there as the bridge between everything that's important and voting rights being one of the most important things that we enjoy as citizens.
I spoke last month with Paula Casey. One of the things we talked about was how recent so much of the recognition is across Tennessee. And I'm sure that Paula has had a lot to do with that. And you and other historians have had a lot to do with that. Tell us more.
Well, and that's so true, because I think that because the early states that jumped on the bandwagon got a lot of attention. And I think even though Tennessee came down to be the perfect 36, I think a lot of the credit for the recognition goes to Paula in particular, because she's been working this area for 20 years trying to bring attention, having others of us that are historians go back and look at the newspaper accounts of the day, to look at the firsthand person accounts of the day, and to get that story out, because as a rule, the truth of the matter is we don't control the media markets nationally. Those are New York, California, Washington, D.C., Chicago, perhaps. More and more we have input, but I think those early stories just disappeared very quickly, and it was not a primary charge of anyone to keep that story alive.
Beyond all eyes on Nashville, on the centennial, what plans are there to further recognize Chattanooga's role in all this?
We are doing a number of things in Chattanooga, and I'm so glad that you asked that, because, you know, on the Centennial Monument that is in Nashville in Centennial Park, Chattanooga is represented by Abby Crawford Milton, and she is our treasurer. Just an absolutely amazing woman who was an attorney by trade, who gets involved very early in the suffrage movement. She becomes the very first president of the Tennessee League of Women Voters. She is the first president of the Tennessee Women's Suffrage Association. She will crisscross the state, all counties, often with her three young daughters accompanying her, because her story says that she said, what better way to learn history than to be a part of it? And I kind of like that. So here in Chattanooga, we're going to be doing a number of things. COVID has impacted some of the things that we had hoped to do. We were going to have a glorious yellow rose tea at Abby Crawford Milton's house, which is now owned by Leah Golden, and she had graciously agreed to that. Well, of course, we can't do that, but we will be celebrating. You'll see signs all over the city talking about Chattanooga's role in the centennial of suffrage. We have a special campaign going on in cooperation with Blood Assurance, the Chattanooga Hamilton County Yellow Rose Committee, with the Chattanooga Bar Association and the Chief John Ross Chapter of the DAR, for a campaign for blood, plasma, and platelets. And anyone who donates, you know, you get a wonderful certificate and a social media posting. You are donating in honor of the first woman in your family to vote. Do you know who your the first woman in your family to vote was, Ray? Because I didn't.
It'd have to be one of my great-grandmothers. Guessing off the top of my head which one, this would be the great-grandmother that was also a member of the Women's Christian Temperance Union.
Oh, and I bet she did, because they were very heavily involved in the campaign, and she probably had a very strong opinion, then probably furthered that vote by continuing with that strong opinion. It's just kind of fascinating, because here I've worked in the area, you know, for several years, and I got to thinking, trying to figure out who was the first woman probably to vote, and it came down to my York great-grandmother was the very first one to vote, and she voted, actually the story is, in opposition to her husband. They were split parties. And she apparently was quite proud of the fact that she had canceled his vote for the first time after all those years of being married.
That doesn't happen anymore, does it?
Isn't that one of the wonderful things about having a free republic is that each person votes their conscience. And you don't have to share that information with each other. We often do. But without the role of active involved citizens, the republic would fail. So, you know, I'm constantly running around with my flag on one side and my please vote on the other side, because this form of government doesn't work without informed electorate.
All right. Linda, thanks so much.
Listen, let's talk history again someday soon.